us and the company we keep. And it's going to be a look at the life of King David and Joab, which, if you've read the book of 2 Samuel, then you know a lot about these two characters. Most of us are probably a lot more familiar with King David. Over the past couple of years, I've been reading through the entire Bible from start to finish with my children every night. We read about a chapter or so every night. So it's taken a while to get through, but it's been a very good practice for them. And while I had known about King David and I'd known of Joab before, as I was reading through the book of 2 Samuel, there's a lot that struck me about their relationship that kind of inspired this lesson. So getting into it. So before I get into the heart of the lesson, I just wanted to bring us back to our theme here, and that's for the year. Nehemiah chapter 2, verse 18, then they said, "Let us arise and build." So they put their hand to the good work. And I think in many regards that applies to how we are trying to build ourselves as a church here locally at Mill Road. And if we aspire to arise and build a stronger local church here for the Lord, then we must be willing to work on our personal relationships. I think the foundation of the Lord's church is clearly Christ, His Son. But what He has given us here in the local church will only grow stronger based on the strength of our individual relationships with each other as Christians. Obviously, our faith in God is a huge part in that, and that's something that we have in common. And I think you can tell when a church is close, when the members of the church are close. As somebody who's traveled a lot with the military and moved around a lot, lost track of the number of churches I've been a member of, but I'll tell you that the nice thing, even though we've only gotten to spend a couple years at each location, is there are many places around the world that I could go, and particularly here in the United States, and I know that there's a warm bed waiting for me if I call up a friend and ask if I can stay. And that isn't from Army friends, that's from the churches that we've been a part of, and knowing that we have that love and that common bond. The Bible is quite clear about the importance of relationships, as we read. And who we choose to associate ourselves with is an incredibly important matter with incredibly profound consequences. We can see here what King Solomon wrote: "He who walks the wise grows wise, and he, the companion of fools, suffers harm." So it's important to think about who we choose to associate with, because that can have eternal consequences if we are not careful to guard our own hearts or to grow our own hearts through those that we associate with. Ezekiel, and I apologize how small these, I tried to put a lot of the scriptures on here, but I'm assuming people in the back are having a hard time reading. But Ezekiel chapter 18, verse 20 says, "The man who sins will die, the righteousness of the righteous will be upon himself, and the wickedness of the wicked will be upon himself." In Romans chapter 2, verse 5 through 8, "But because of your stubbornness and unrepentant heart, you are storing up wrath for yourself in the day of wrath and revelation of the righteous judgment of God, will render to each person according to his deeds. To those who by perseverance in doing good seek for glory and honor and immortality, eternal life, but to those who are selfishly ambitious and do not obey the truth, but obey unrighteousness, wrath and indignation." In 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 10, "For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each one may be recompensed for his deeds in the body according to what he has done, whether good or bad." And I think what's clear across all these scriptures, and there are more, is that each of us are held individually accountable. So that's an important principle to remember. While our associations will not be judged on their actions can either make our lives as Christians much easier or much more difficult. King David, it's easy to, I think, overlook a lot of the problematic times of David's life, because even though we know he's far from perfect, we have these scriptures here, like 1 Samuel 13, 14, that say the Lord has sought out for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord has appointed him as a ruler over his people. And in Acts chapter 13, 22, scripture makes it clear that that phrase was said about David. That David was raised up to be their king, concerning whom he also testified and said, "I have found David, the son of Jesse, a man after my heart, whom will do all my will." And I think those are the scriptures we tend to remember about King David, even before he was king. And it can make it easy for us to overlook some of the more problematic things that happened to David's life. But when we stop and take a look at the book of 2 Samuel, and we look at all the problematic things that happened in David's life and all the wrongdoings that he committed or the sin that so easily entangled him, there's one common denominator in just about every one of those circumstances, and that's this man, Joab. So who was Joab? Joab, according to 1 Chronicles chapter 2, verse 13 and 16, Jesse became the father of David. David was his seventh son, and his sisters were Zeruiah and Abigail. And the three sons of Zeruiah were Abishai, Joab, and Asahel. So Joab was one of David's nephews. But perhaps more important and more profound in the relationship was, we see in 2 Samuel chapter 8, verse 15 and 16, David appointed Joab as the ruler over his army. He was the top general in David's army. So they had a very close relationship, king to the top general of his army, and as well tied by that family relation. But when we start looking at pretty early on in David's rule, 2 Samuel chapter 2, verse 18 to 23, we see how Abner was Saul's top general. So when the country was divided between some going for David and some going for Saul and wanting Saul's family to continue the line, Abner was the leader of the other, basically the other half of the fight, wanting Saul's line to continue. And So what we see in chapter 2 of 2 Samuel is that Abner is on the run from David's army after a small battle. And Abner's brother, Asahel, I think the Bible describes him as being as fleet-footed as a gazelle. So he's a very fast runner. And he's chasing down Abner. And Abner calls back and says something to the effect of, "Hey, leave me alone, like I don't want to have to kill you." And Asahel continues to chase him. And I think he gives him the second warning. And then eventually it says, and it's a pretty violent text, it talks about how Abner takes a spear and thrusts it behind him, and it goes completely through Asahel's stomach, pierces out the other side. He kills him. Now, this was an act of self-defense, and David forgives him for it. And he actually tries to make peace with Abner and says, "Hey, Abner, come over. Please, let's unite the kingdom. Let's all try and serve God together." Well, Joab was the older brother of Asahel, and did not take too kindly to this. He did not understand why David would forgive the man that killed his brother. So in an act of deceit, when Abner comes back to Jerusalem, Joab pulls him aside and murders him. It says it's done right there at the city gates. David, also not happy about this. And in fact, right at the beginning of David's rule, he starts off and says, "Afterward, when David heard it, he said, 'I and my kingdom are innocent before the Lord forever of the blood of Abner, the son of Ner. May it fall on the head of Joab and on all his father's house. And may there not fail from the house of Joab one who has a discharge, or who is a leper, or who takes hold of a distaff, or who falls by the sword, or who lacks bread.' So Joab and Abishai his brother killed Abner because he had put their brother Asahel to death in the battle at Gibeon." So David actually curses Joab. But he doesn't go so far as to actually remove Joab from his life, doesn't remove him from his generalship. He keeps him around. Even after cursing him and saying, I hope he has trouble all his life and all his family as well because of this act. And I think it's important to draw a distinction here. Some might say that perhaps this is justified revenge on Joab's part, but that's not the case. I think it's pretty obvious here, actually, if you read back in verse 30, that the way the Lord looked at it, Abner killed their brother Asahel in self-defense, it says, in battle, in death at battle at Gibeon. What Joab did to Abner was deceive him, pull him aside, and then murder him. There's a difference there, a distinction that's being drawn. And while in both cases somebody ended up dead, and that's tragic, one was justified in one regard, and the other was clearly not. And I think this is where we really see Joab starting to show his true colors for the kind of man that he was and the kind of, I dare say, leader that he was. When you move along to the next phase in David's life where he experienced some issues, that was the moving of the ark. And that he starts off this is only a couple chapters later in chapter 6, by, now David gathered all the chosen men of Israel, 30,000. That's his army. And who is his general? Joab. So Joab was clearly a part of this. And David rose and went with all the people who were with him to Baal Judah, to bring up from there the Ark of God, which is called by the name, the very name of the Lord of the hosts, who is enthroned above the cherubim. They placed the Ark of God on a new cart that they might bring it from the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill, and Uzzah and Ahio, the sons of Abinadab, were leading the new cart. So they brought up with the Ark of God from the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill, and Ahio was walking ahead of the Ark. Meanwhile, David and all the house of Israel were celebrating before the Lord with all kinds of instruments made of fir, wood, and with lyres, harps and tambourines, castanets and cymbals. But when they came to the threshing floor of Nacon, Uzzah reached out toward the Ark of God and took hold of it, for the oxen nearly upset it. And the anger of the Lord burned against Uzzah, and God struck him down for his irreverence, and he died there by the Ark of God. David became angry because of the Lord's outburst against Uzzah, and that place is called Perez Uzzah to this day. I think what's important here is that the Israelites knew how to move God's Ark. I mean, there's no question. This is a day where oral histories were a big thing, and guess what? They carried the Ark properly from the wilderness into Israel, crossing the Jordan, the Levitical priests holding it on their shoulders. Everybody knew this story. Everybody knew how the Ark was supposed to be transported. And clearly, on an ox cart was not the right answer. And Uzzah, I think, yes, he made a mistake, and clearly he paid for that mistake. I think he was trying to ensure that God's Ark did not fall and hit the ground. It was in violation of God's law to begin with, and all this is David's fault. David made this choice, and Joab had a part in it, and not being a good advisor, so arguably the general was probably the top advisor to the king in most matters, especially ones that involved his army being moved around. There's no way that neither Uzzah or David has a valid excuse for not knowing what was right in the circumstance. And Joab failed to properly advise David. Again, we all know the story of David and Bathsheba. Moving on to 2 Samuel chapter 11, David commits his sin with Bathsheba. We'll skip through the pretext on that, but then he tries to cover it up by bringing Uriah in. Now, Uriah was out at war with Joab, the general. And David sends a note to Joab saying, "Hey, send me back Uriah." Well, this is kind of an odd request. Why? Joab doesn't question it. He just sends back Uriah, does what the king says, but there's no question as to why are you asking for this man back. And when David fails to actually cover up his own sin the way he initially intended to with Uriah, he directs Joab to arrange for Uriah's death in battle. He tries to commit murder by proxy. And again, Joab has no compulsion or no compunction about being complicit in this. He easily agrees to play his part. He puts Uriah right at the front lines. Now, he doesn't do it exactly the way David said. David said put him at the front lines where the battle will be fiercest, and then have all your other men draw back so that he will be struck down dead. Instead, I won't belabor this point, but instead, Joab actually sends his people up against the wall, and many of them are killed, Uriah being among them. The unfortunate thing is Uriah is the only one we know about by name that dies in this, but it sounds like there were actually multiple others of David's mighty men that are killed as a result of this cover-up of one person. And we see in the end there that it says that when the time of mourning was over, David sent and brought her to his house, and she became his wife, and she bore him a son. But the thing that David had done was evil in the sight of the Lord. So David sinned of his own accord. Joab had nothing to do with the initial sin. He attempted to help the initial cover-up, and then he ultimately ensured that Uriah was murdered to ensure that David got his way, at least in this one small part, in covering up his own sin so that the people wouldn't know, so that he wouldn't be embarrassed, so that David wouldn't be inconvenienced. And it's really a sad story. It's actually even, maybe from a human perspective, a little more dramatic and a little more sad is that David actually made Uriah carry a sealed envelope with his own death orders written on it back to Joab. And when Joab opened that letter, he knew exactly what happened. He knew the betrayal of David against Uriah. And I can't imagine many other reasons. I think, although we don't know what the contents of the letter were beyond make sure that this guy dies, and in this way, we don't know that David confessed his sin to Joab in any way, but there aren't too many other reasons why David would have done this, right? I think Joab probably knew what was going on. It's perhaps a guess, but Joab was aware and did not advise, once again, his king against this terrible course of action that he was taking. He didn't take seriously the service that David was supposed to be doing to God first. In 2 Samuel chapter 13 through chapter 18, we won't read it all, but we see the story of Absalom, one of David's older sons, and how it starts in chapter 13 with Amnon and Tamar, two other children of David, and a very terrible circumstance there in which Amnon takes his sister forcibly. And as a result, Absalom murders Amnon, his other brother. So I think there's some half relationships in here because David had multiple wives. But I think what's clear is that David's children did not have a great influence beyond him in their life. And one of those reasons is because of Joab being kept around. And we don't see a direct relationship between Joab and all of David's children, but the top general in David's army, his top advisor, probably around the palace whenever he's not out at war, the children see that. They see the kind of man that David's tolerating in his life and around his family. And there's an influence there. There's no question in my mind that a lot of this trouble that David has with his children is probably a result of what he tolerated in the man that he kept around his family and kept around his kingdom and kept around as a leader. Not just tolerated to live and be in the kingdom, but actually continue to prop him up and keep him as an example to the people of, this is the kind of warrior I want. Whether or not he actually said those words, his actions spoke loud enough that people knew that Joab and his behavior was in some regard acceptable to David. And that's a sad statement. And when Absalom runs away after murdering his brother Amnon, because he's afraid of his father the king and that he will come back and take revenge against Absalom for the killing of Amnon. These names are so similar, I apologize. He runs away, and then Joab arranges for him to come back. So Absalom comes back, and then David says, "Oh, I don't want to see you. Go to your farm." Never sees his face. Joab is the one that arranged for him to come back, so Absalom starts pestering Joab, saying, "Hey, like, can you arrange for an audience for me with the king?" And Joab ignores him. Twice, I think it says, and then Absalom actually lights fire to Joab's fields to make him angry. So then Joab eventually arranges for that face-to-face between Absalom and King David. And then Absalom, I think, in his bitterness about how all this happened, about how he was called back and then not given an audience to the king for so long, and then being ignored as well by the general who had the placement and access to arrange for it, he decides, you know what, I can do a better job than those two. And he starts arranging this conspiracy, and he starts intercepting all these people that would come to the king and bring their pleas before the king, and tries to provide justice on his own regard and under his own name as a son of the king, and tries to prop himself up, and eventually does actually launch a successful coup in some regards. He moves to Hebron, which was, if you look back, was the initial city where David ruled from in Israel before he took Jerusalem, and he announces himself as king. And then for several chapters, we see David is on the run from his son Absalom and from his army. And eventually, Joab starts winning some battles for David, and then in a counter-revolution, is able to place David back on the throne. Now, when David's coming back to his position of power, he tells Joab and the two other generals that he had, it says, in front of all the people, he tells them, so everybody knew, preserve the life of my son Absalom. You're going to go hunt him down, but I want him brought back to me alive. says, the king charged Joab and Abishai and Ittai, saying, deal gently for my sake with the young men Absalom. And all the people heard when the king charged all the commanders concerning him. And the people went out into, this is 2 Samuel chapter 18, verse 6. Then the people went out into the field against Israel, and the battle took place in the forest of Ephraim. The people of Israel were defeated there before the servants of David, and the slaughter there that day was great, 20,000 men. For the battle there was spread over the whole countryside, and the forest devoured more people that day than the sword devoured. Now Absalom happened to meet the servants of David, for Absalom was riding on his mule, and the mule went under the thick branches of a great oak, and his head caught fast in the oak. So that he was left hanging between heaven and earth, while the mule that was under him kept going. When a certain man saw it, he told Joab and said, behold, I saw Absalom hanging in an oak. And Joab said to the man who had told him, now behold, you saw him. Why then did you not strike him there to the ground? And I would have given you 10 pieces of silver and a belt. The man said to Joab, even if I should receive 1,000 pieces of silver in my hand, I would not put out my hand against the king's son. For in our hearing, the king charged you and Abishai and Ittai, saying, protect for me the young man Absalom. Otherwise, if I had dealt treacherously against his life, and there is nothing hidden from the king, then you yourself would have stood aloof. And Joab said, I will not waste time here with you. So he took 3 spears in his hand and thrust them through the heart of Absalom while he was yet alive in the midst of the oak. And 10 young men who carried Joab's armor gathered around and struck Absalom and killed him. So yet again, another example of Joab committing murder, and this time it's the king's own son. Again, expressly against David's will and David's command. And everybody heard it. And we can see the influence of Joab, because it says the 10 young men who carried his armor joined in on it. They were like, oh, well, I guess this is cool. This is what we're doing now. And they contributed to the murder of Absalom. You know, and actually, before I move on, I think it's also important to note that so Joab's sin and his lies beget more of it. If you read the rest of the story, and it's not a terribly long chapter, but we see that Joab instructs the messenger to lie to David about how Absalom died, or at least deceive and leave out key details like, I'm the one that murdered him, kind of a key detail there. And then there's another man, Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, who asks to run and bring the message. And he says, no, you shouldn't be the one. Perhaps he didn't trust that guy to partake in the deceit. But Ahimaaz actually overtakes the Cushite, who observed the death and was sent as the initial messenger, and gets David first. And he does actually participate in the deceit. Both these men, both messengers, knew what actually happened, and neither one specifically ever said, Joab is the one that ordered your son's death. They let David assume that Absalom died in the course of battle, not as a matter of murder. It's really sad that this influence that Joab has over the army and over the people leads to all these other sins happening. And as a result, Joab gets off from this. There's no consequence. And in fact, when we see later when David's recounting about all the terrible things that Joab did, David doesn't mention that Absalom was murdered by him. He mentions Amasa, who we're about to talk about in a few minutes, and Abner, but he doesn't even mention his own son. And you'd think that if David knew about this when he's retelling the story to Solomon about how terrible Joab is, that his own son would have come up. But he doesn't. So I think this deceit carries through for the rest of David's life. So Amasa was Absalom's top general. So once again, just like with Abner, David and the attempt to reunify the kingdom after being split, he says to Amasa, may God do so to me and more also if you will not be commander of the army before me continually in place of Joab. So this is the one time that David attempts to replace Joab, and maybe as an attempt to cut him and his poor influence out of his life, by replacing him with Amasa, but I think this is also an olive branch that he was extending to the other side of the kingdom that had revolted against him. He's trying to bring everybody back and reunify the kingdom under his rule for God's sake and for the people of God to be unified and united. And we see here, in just one chapter later, Joab is not a man who's going to suffer this lightly. He's been displaced. He doesn't like it. He doesn't like not being the top general. Maybe he's number two or three now. We don't get the details on just how far down the rung ladders he fell. But when we see in 2 Samuel chapter 20, verse 9, Joab said to Amasa, "Is it well with you, my brother?" And Joab took Amasa by the beard with his right hand to kiss him. And actually, before I move on, it's important to note that Amasa was another nephew of David. So this was one of Joab's cousins. But Amasa was not on guard against the sword which was in Joab's hand. So he struck him in the belly with it and poured out his inward parts on the ground and did not strike him again, and he died. Then Joab and Abishai, his brother, pursued Sheba, the son of Bichri. Now there stood by him one of Joab's young men, and said, "Whoever favors Joab and whoever is for David, let him follow Joab." But Amasa lay wallowing in his blood in the middle of the highway. And when the men saw that all the people stood still, when the man saw that all the people stood still, he removed Amasa from the highway into the field and threw a garment over him, when he saw that everyone who came by him stood still. So everybody saw it. We saw what Joab just did. He's got another act of murder. It's a man who's not afraid to get his hands dirty to get what he wants. And it says right here that the men who stood by him, Joab's young men, immediately propped him back up as the general. And this didn't go back to David for decision. Joab was just the general again because the guy who had supplanted him was now dead and murdered by his own hand. Yet another circumstance in which David gets himself in some trouble is the census. And this is near the end of David's rule. It's the last chapter of 2 Samuel, chapter 24. David's upset with the Lord, and it says, and he says, "Now again the anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and it incited David against them to say, 'Go number Israel and Judah.'" So the Lord's upset with Israel, and David's upset with the Lord. And David acts rashly and says, "You know what? I'm pretty strong on my own, but I want to know just how strong I am. Go tell me how many people are out there." And to his credit, Joab does actually attempt to initially advise against this and say, "The king said to Joab, the commander of the army who was with him, 'Go about now through all the tribes of Israel from Dan to Beersheba and register the people that I may know the number of the people.' But Joab said to the king, 'Now may the Lord your God add to the people 100 times as many as there are while the eyes of my lord the king still see. But why does my lord the king delight in this thing?'" So what's interesting to me, so I will give Joab a little bit of credit here. He does try and lightly persuade David otherwise. He says, but he doesn't use a particularly convincing argument, and David pursues this and goes ahead and wants to commit the sin of hubris. But what's interesting to me is Joab's argument against it isn't about necessarily or at least he doesn't argue it very effectively, that this will anger the Lord even further, or why are you doing this? This is like just a matter of your pride. This is silly. You're sending your army out to do something that's a waste of our time. He doesn't, and will anger the Lord. Like, there's never that line of argument that might have persuaded David otherwise, that might have made him realize this is wrong, not just because it's a misuse of your resources, but because the Lord would not like it. That doesn't enter into the argument. And David pursues his sin, but when he repents of his hubris, God gives him three choices for his punishment. So Gad came to David and told him and said to him, "Shall 7 years of famine come to you in your land? Or will you flee 3 months before your foes while they pursue you? Or shall there be 3 days pestilence in your land? Now consider and see what answer I shall return to him who sent me." And David chooses the 3 days of pestilence. And actually he says, "I'm in great distress. Let us now fall into the hand of the Lord, for his mercies are great, but do not let me fall into the hand of man." So this was David's sin, but he's not willing to take the consequence just on himself. Only one of these actually was a consequence that was actually going to primarily just affect David, and that was if he decided to flee for 3 months from the hand of his enemies. And what's interesting is it's a very defined timeline. God says it'll only be 3 months, therefore indicating that you will be restored after that punishment's over. But David chooses the 3 days of pestilence, and it says that in those 3 days, 70,000 men of the people from Dan to Beersheba died. So the consequence of David's sin, a sin which Joab was consulted in and did not persuade him against, not effectively anyway, and therefore enabled his sin, resulted in the death of 70,000. And the final act of betrayal on Joab's part is 1 Kings chapter 1, verse 5 through 7. You see, now Adonijah, the son of Haggith, exalted him, saying, I will be king. So he prepared for himself chariots and horsemen with 50 men to run before him. His father had never crossed him at any time by asking, why have you done so? He was also a very handsome man, and he was born after Absalom. He had conferred with Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and with Abiathar, the priest, and following Adonijah, they helped him. So we see that one of David's older sons at this point, that's still alive, Adonijah, is essentially plotting a coup. David's still alive. He's still on the throne. He has told Bathsheba that Solomon will be the king, but that wasn't a public pronouncement. Nobody knew that the line of succession was going to go to Solomon at this point. So Adonijah, seeing his father as perhaps weak and feckless, goes to Joab. And again, evidence that this man was not a great influence in David's family. And ask for help, saying, hey, will you put me on the throne? And it says, Joab participates in this. He followed behind, and they helped him. So Adonijah goes ahead and gets himself exalted up on the throne. All the people are cheering that it's for him. Well, Nathan the prophet and some others, I think Zadok the priest, Benaiah, son of Jehoiada, and Nathan the prophet, all came to him. They were still faithful to David. Despite what they saw going on and David being on, actually we see in the beginning of the chapter that David's, doesn't say on his deathbed, but he's not doing well, and they have somebody basically hand feeding him. So he was in a weak state at this point, but they go and advise him, saying, hey, I don't think this is what you want. Adonijah's not the guy to replace you. Haven't you said that Solomon will be the one? And David confirms yes, and he brings him Bathsheba and says, I promise to you that your son Solomon will be king after me. So Zadok the priest and Nathan the prophet and Benaiah the son of Jehoiada, they all go about and get Solomon on the throne. And Adonijah, for fear of his life, goes ahead and puts himself in the horn of the altars and begs for mercy on Solomon's side. So Solomon's instated as king. Adonijah renounces his claim to the throne, at least initially. And then David has this conversation before his death with his son Solomon. He says, now you also know that Joab, the son of Zeruiah, did to me, that he did to the two commanders of the armies of Israel, to Abner the son of Ner, and to Amasa the son of Jether, whom he killed. He also shed the blood of war and peace, and he put the blood of war on his belt about his waist, and on his sandals on his feet. So act according to your wisdom, and do not let his gray hair go down to Sheol in peace. So we see here David knew all along the man that Joab was. And in fact, that first story talks about Abner, son of Ner, that was very early in David's rule. David, I think the estimate was about 30, 32 when he was initially became king. He ruled for about 40 years, so he was in his 70s at this point. And he knew that entire time, because that was year one that he killed Abner, entire time that Joab was this terrible murderer. A violent man who made terrible decisions, did not give good advice, and maybe was very, very competent as a general in winning wars and winning battles, but was not a good man. Not a good man to keep around his family. Not a good man to be propped up as a leader within Israel. But yet he tolerated him. He tolerated Joab and his sin. But we see here the evidence that David knew. David knew all along. Just the man, the kind of man that Joab was. So we don't necessarily know why David tolerated it. We're never given that explicit insight. Perhaps it's that David kept him around because he was family. Maybe he did actually love him despite his many flaws that were, I think, obvious to all. It's even possible that David kept him around because sometimes leaders think it's convenient to keep a man around who's willing to get his hands dirty. We don't know. It is possible. But what we do know is that almost every single event in David's life that we just reviewed, Joab had part in it. And all these events were like the banner events for terrible things that happened to David, or that David caused, or that happened to the kingdom because of David's decisions. And Joab was around for every single one of them. You know, the results here are pretty obvious. He murdered Abner, Uriah, and Amasa. He murdered David's son Absalom. He carried out an order that he knew to be against God's will, and 70,000 people died. He enabled another son to commit a coup against David. And all the while, and I think this is the most tragic part, is that David's children and his family were exposed to the sinful man who were likely strongly influenced by that poor example. This is the kind of company that David kept. And it's what's sad is we see, so their interests were not aligned. I mean, they were on a physical plane. Like, they were both trying to keep Israel strong. So their interests aligned in that regard. But in the important thing, the most important thing, and that's serving God, this is not a mutually supportive relationship. Joab enabled David to sin many times. He committed many sins that were of great consequence to David and caused him a lot of grief. And Joab's concern was not about making sure that David was a godly ruler. Joab's concerns were making sure that David was a strong man ruler in a very physical sense, that he was the king that the Israelites were looking for when they wanted a king to be established. What they thought they were getting from Saul, which turned out to not be, that's the kind of king that they were trying to, that Joab was trying to make sure David was. David was, as we know, the Bible says, and we can trust it, that he was a man after God's own heart. And he did repent many times after all these issues. We see that. David had a heart that was, while he made mistakes, he was still a good man, and God called him that. So I'm not trying to say that David was an evil king. I'm just saying that it's obvious that in all his troubles, there's a common denominator, and that was a man that he tolerated to be around him. So when we look at Matthew chapter 10, verse 32 to 35, it says, "Therefore, everyone who confesses me before men, I will also confess him before my Father who is in heaven. But whoever denies me before men, I will also deny him before my Father who is in heaven. Do not think that I came to bring peace on the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I came to set a man against his father, and a daughter against his mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And a man's enemies will be the members of his household. He who loves his father more or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me." And I think it's important to note that what Christ meant here is that not that we should hate our family relations, but rather that our love for Christ must be so much more. And I think sometimes it's important to remember that not all of us, I know there are some in the room who are very fortunate to have all their family members, or at least the majority of them, that are also believers. That's not the case for most Christians, I don't think. And while we have those relationships, and I'm not saying anybody should shun their family, I'm just saying it's important to remember the order of importance that God wants us to place on our relationships, and that we shouldn't tolerate people in our lives, whether they're family or not, who are dragging us down and not allowing us to be aligned with God's will, and not enabling us or strengthening us or encouraging us to do what God expects of us. The company we keep must be the church and God's other believers. Ephesians 4, verse 3 through 4 says, "Be diligent, preserve the unity of the Spirit and the bond of peace. There is one body and one Spirit, just as you also were called in one hope." In 1 Peter 2, 5, "You also, as living stones, are being built up as a spiritual house for a holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ." The Bible talks in many places about how the believers in a local church are being built together, that we are one body, that we must work together, and we must love each other, that we must be willing to make sacrifices for each other, and that those relationships are very important. The Bible is clear on this point. Now, I know most of that is so small you probably can't read it back there, because I'm having trouble reading it on the screen right in front of me. These are 30 specific commandments from throughout the New Testament that I call the one another commandments. And I've got all the scriptures there, and I can, if you're interested, I can get you these scriptures later. But when you read, and some of them, most of these, depending on the version or translation that you're going through, are commandments for what brethren must do for one another. So, for example, in John 13, 34, 35, it says, "Love one another." The next one, "Bear one another's burdens, care for one another, comfort one another, be compassionate towards one another, consider one another, have fellowship with one another, be kind to one another, be affectionate to one another, prefer one another, exhort one another, minister to one another, provoke to love and good works, teach one another, show hospitality to one another, be humble, showing tolerance towards one another, be like-minded, serve one another, be subject to one another, submit to one another, receive and accept one another, greet one another, speak to one another, Confess your faults to one another. Forbear with one another. Forgive one another. Pray with one another. Tarry with one another. Admonish one another and edify one another. And there's actually like 7 or 8 more that are on the do not do to each other list for what Christians are not supposed to do to other Christians. I didn't bring those up. But my point in this is you see the relationship that David and Joab had and how that was a terrible relationship and it was not mutually reinforcing. They were not supporting each other, being more spiritual. And all of David's grief stemmed from that. But what we have, what we are offered in the local church are all these wonderful things that we can do for one another and that we're expected to do for one another. And those are the relationships we should treasure and value. And this was the bottom left one. Be devoted to one another in brotherly love, giving preference to one another in honor, not lagging behind in diligence, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord, rejoicing in hope, persevering in tribulation, devoted to prayer, contributing to the needs of the saints, and practicing hospitality. The friendships that we can build within the Lord's church are incredibly special. They're unlike anything you're likely to find anywhere else in the world. Now, some of us might have some really good friends outside the church that are not dragging us down. We might not be Christians, but that we can maintain good bonds with people that are not Christians. I'm not trying to say that we should not be friends with people in the world. In fact, I think the Bible speaks against that and says we shouldn't be like monks cloistered away from the world, not being able, because then how are we ever going to be able to influence people to also join us here in the pews and get baptized and add themselves to Christ's kingdom? I'm not saying don't be friends with people in the world. I am saying be selective about the people that you tolerate and in your life when they are not a good influence on you or on your family, or if they are detracting from your ability to live a spiritual life. Those are the pearls before swine type argument. We can't continue to give ourselves and allow ourselves to have relationships with people that pull us away from God rather than push us toward Him. And I think the best place you will find meaningful relationships in this world that will help push you towards God are the other people in this room and other rooms with people just like this all around the world that are today on the first day of the week worshiping the Lord. Those are the relationships that Romans 12 is telling us to give preference to one another. We should prefer the company of other Christians. The Lord gave us this local church as an instrument of encouragement and His great wisdom, and we need to take advantage of that tremendous gift, and we need to work towards building those relationships with each other and treasuring those above all other types of relationships. Now, there's a lot of other types of relationships that other sermons can be given on that will help build up the local church. I mean, you could talk about marriage relationship. You can talk about the relationship between parents and their children. But today I was just talking about those friendships, those common bonds that we should have and that we should strive to have with other Christians, and that we should protect ourselves from with those who are not like-minded. I hope that was encouraging to you this morning. I have not been talking about specifically what is expected of us in becoming Christians and how you can join in and get the benefits, these many benefits that we saw in this, about how we can become more spiritually minded and how we can encourage one another. But to have access to that, there's a starting point. You have to hear the word of Christ. You have to believe it. You have to confess that Christ is your Lord and Savior. And you have to be willing to get baptized, to be added to the Lord's church. And I hope that if there are any of you who are on that path, that you would let us know, that we might pray for you and might help you along. If you feel that you are ready for the waters of baptism, then we have a baptistry available, and we are willing and able, and we'd be more than happy. In fact, we'd be overjoyed to add you to our number. So if there are any who have that need this morning, please come forward as we stand and sing.